After their evening meal, Preacher and his companion staked out floor-level straw-stuffed mattresses and then went in search of distraction. Antoine and Three Sleeps found the bar. For Preacher, distraction turned out to be a gaming table. Five men sat around the green baize circle when he approached.
"Evening, gents. My answer to Preacher."
One of the men flashed Preacher a deep scowl.
"Oh, no. I'm not going to give you a sermon on the evils of gambling. Matter of fact, if there's room, I'd be obliged for an invite to join the game."
Abandoning his scowl, the pudgy, soft-handed man produced a welcoming smile.
"My name's Jessup. I own this place. These gentlemen are noble followers of the bullwhacker calling. Sit down, Preacher. Your money's as good as any man's."
Jessup had his hair slicked down and smelled of bay rum. He had small, close-set eyes that missed meanness due to a warm, friendly twinkle. He and the others completed the hand while Preacher dumped a stack of gold pieces on the table. Jessup passed the deck to the man on his right, who nodded to Preacher.
"Among teamsters, I'm known as Long Tom. What's your pleasure?"
"Well, you name it, Tom."
Introductions went around the table, and Preacher met Billy Green, Hank Lupton, and Frank Spence. Long Tom shuffled.
"Five-card stud."
Preacher played tight and smart. He let go of a good portion of his money during the first four games, taking time to learn everyone's tells. By the time the fifth hand was dealt, Preacher had learned enough to start taking some pretty decent-sized pots. Preacher was always careful not to win too much in order to keep the games enjoyable for all of the players. Still, by the time he pushed his chair out to leave, his poke stuck out considerably further than when he had first come in.
"Well, thank you, gents, for a right entertaining evening. Now I need to get me some shut-eye before the sun catches me by surprise. Night."
Have a nightcap, Preacher. On me."
"No, thank you kindly, but no thanks. I do need my sleep."
Makepeace Baxter had been badly misnamed by his doting parents. As a child, he had made war on small animals, tormenting them until they died. He loved to pull one wing off of several flies and watch them crawl around in circles until they dropped over from starvation. Another favorite was to pull the legs from frogs and toss them in a water trough to drown. His absolute favorite was to catch a cat on the tines of a pitchfork and watch it writhe to a horrible death. When he entered his teens, his taste became more refined. He tortured children smaller than himself and threatened to kill them if they told. Once, at the age of 14, he went too far. A child died, and he ran away from home to live the next 3 months in terror of being caught and accused. Makepeace never went back. Over the ensuing years, he had found his niche among the lowest of the low in the ranks of criminals. He robbed and often maimed drunks for what money they might have. Lately, in this forsaken part of Injun territory, he had taken up with the pair who sighted him tonight. Now a hulking 18, he crouched in the sagebrush at the edge of the clearing on the southeast side of the creek created by the Lost Springs. With him were his best friends, his only friends, truth be told. Youthful louts, actually, who could stomach his sadistic ways. Lights had been lowered in the hotel portion of the stage station, and the only sign of life came from the tavern. Makepeace hummed with anticipation. A bright, tall rectangle bloomed when the door to the tavern opened, and out came the mountain man.
"Ham, he's the one. He won big in that game."
Preacher turned in the direction of the hotel and was striding toward the entrance when the three pieces of human debris made their move. Baxter leaped at the man in buckskins. What he caught was a fistful of knuckles. Makepeace landed on his butt. He dimly saw the man he attacked raise a leg.
"Looking to bushwhack me, boy?"
That was when Nate and Willie joined in, grabbing hold of Preacher by both arms. An instant later, they went flying as Preacher flung his arms wide. Then Preacher slammed a fist into the side of Baxter's head, which made his ear ring. By then, Nate had regained his balance and gone for the mountain man again. Preacher met him with a grin on his face, dodged a wild left, and put a looping right into the pudding face of the 20-year-old thug. Nate came to a sudden stop. His arms sagged, and Preacher gave a frightful punishment to his ribs. Nate flailed wildly at Preacher to no avail. Preacher finished him with a sharp uppercut that clapped Nate's mouth shut. But then, Willie Slaughter had screwed up his courage and he came at Preacher. The mountain man let him approach, then sidestepped and whacked Willie in the side with his forearm. Next, Preacher grabbed the youthful bandit by the hair and yanked him backward. Willie's feet went out from under him and he went down hard. Preacher paused and looked around himself, well pleased. But that's when Makepeace Baxter got back in the fray. He came at Preacher with a knife. Moonlight gave the edge a wicked blue glint. Preacher had his own Green River in hand in an instant. The knife fighter squared off.
Come on! Stand still and fight like a man!
I am, you little bastard. You been in a knife fight before?
No.
What's your name?
Why you want to know?
So I have it right on your goddamn gravestone.
It's Baxter! Makepeace Baxter! And you're the one who's gonna die!
I reckon you'd best make some of that peace with the Almighty, because you're gonna meet him real soon.
Preacher backstepped and circled in the other direction. Makepeace followed him. Preacher's moccasin landed on a loose pebble and caused him to stumble. At once, Makepeace rushed his opponent. He made a powerful slash and sensed the contact his blade made. Preacher took a back step, then plunged his Green River to the hilt and the chest of Makepeace.
You can't help me.
You didn't leave me much choice.
Who are you?
They call me Preacher.
Oh, Jesus. I've been done in by the best.
Yes, sir. That you have.
Preacher turned and walked away. He felt a lightness at his waist and reached down. During the brief fight, Makepeace had slashed open his money pouch. Half his winnings lay scattered in the dusty station yard.
Oh, damn it. Now I'll have to crawl around in the dark picking it up like a beggar. By God, tomorrow just has got to be better.
Eve Billings tried once more to reason with the hard-headed men of their wagon train.
We must move on. Several children have taken a fever from some unknown source, and even more are likely to.
Fever's fever. We don't have to know what caused it.
If we knew what caused it, we could avoid it, Gus. I suspect the water is tainted somehow. I've been boiling all of mine before giving any to my children. Little Anna is improving rapidly. No more stomach pain and the fever is lower.
I say we should stay where we are. No one knows what's out there.
Enos Throcker stepped forward.
Yeah, look what happened when we tried. We got plumb lost.
Send out scouts.
They'll never find their way back.
There are several older boys and young men who are level-headed enough. They can tell north from south and read signs. They can mark the trail for us on piles of stones.
Wouldn't do. What if we wandered off between the piles of rocks?
Eve thought that over for a moment. Somewhere she'd read something that might work. It came to her after a long pause in which all the men began to hope they had silenced her.
There is a way. Do any of you know the story of Llano Estacado? The staked plains down in Texas?
No.
When the Spanish explorers first went there, they found a vast desert. Not a tree to guide them, no way to lay out a trail for others to follow. The leader had an idea. He had the soldiers ride back to the last stand of tall, young saplings. They cut poles from them, hundreds of them, oh, maybe 15 feet high. To these, they attached big flags. The leader had one set up at the edge of the rolling area of sand and rocks. Then they started off, taking the other poles with them. When they reached a spot nearly out of the sight of the first pole, they erected another. Then they moved on and put up more flags. Each staff was numbered, so if they wandered and came upon one, they would know where they were and which way to go. And it worked exactly like the leader said it would. They crossed that barren, waterless wasteland and went on to found Santa Fe.
Oh, when did they do that?
Almost 300 years ago.
Oh, there, you see? Old-fashioned ideas like that won't get us anywhere.
That's plain crazy. If we send out the older boys and some young men with arms to protect themselves and a wagon load of poles and flags, they could mark the trail the same way. Even come back if they needed more or if they ran into trouble. After a couple of days' head start, the train can load up on water and any game we can get and follow the markers.
Silence answered her. Eve looked around, her features set in grim determination.
What about you, David? Do you think it would work?
The 16-year-old David Honeycutt shot his eyes to his father, who shook his head in the negative. But the boy took a deep breath and made his first bold venture at independence.
Yeah, I do think it would work, and it'd be a great adventure.
David's father took a menacing step in his direction.
Leave it be, Pa. We ain't getting anywhere just sitting up here eating our supplies.
Well, it quickly got out of Eve's hands. With the prospect of something, anything to do besides sit around, the young men of the train clamored to go along. The decision made, those who would take the risks decided to set off that afternoon to find and cut a wagon load of lodgepole pines. Meanwhile, their mothers and sisters would fashion flags from any bright material they had at hand. They would start off within 2 days, taking the wagon and 3 saddle mounts. Hunkered down in a tall stand of wild mulberry, the spiky-haired lout who had dogged the mountain men along the Santa Fe Trail stared out at the deeply rutted roadway.
Any time now.
Amos Scragg's excitement was growing. He itched. He twitched. Uneasily, he cut his eyes left and right. His Ace Boone running pard, Miguel Lopez, sheltered behind a fallen tree to the right. 5 others were close in by the road. Strung out on both sides of the trail were the surviving dozen of the gang that had attacked the freight wagon train. They'd been paid well to locate and kill the mountain man known as Preacher. They'd attacked the wagons out of greed, but their specific charge had been to see that Preacher, and anyone with him, never lived to reach the Missouri side of the river of the same name. Now their chance had come.
Sounds like 4 horses. Gotta be them.
Amos saw the one called Preacher come into view first. He lined up his sights. Bright sun no longer slanted into Preacher's eyes when he reined in. Shadows had grown so short they had become pools around the bases of the objects that made them. He estimated their morning's travel had brought him close to Diamond Springs Crossing. Another 4 days should see him into Missouri. He had traveled the Santa Fe Trail 3 times before and felt confident with that assessment. He turned to share that with his friends.
Son of a bitch!
Preacher slid the hawk from its scabbard.
By damn, we're being ambushed!
I figured that out for myself. I see some of them over there!
Preacher raised his hawk. To his right, Antoine emptied his hawk into the face of a pasty-skinned outlaw who broke from cover. Antoine quickly drew one of his single-barreled pistols from the saddle holsters and chopped a hole through the underbrush with a double-shotted load. He bolstered the empty weapon and drew one of 2 double-barreled pistols from the wide red sash around his hard, flat middle. He cut his eyes to his companions and saw Preacher unlimber one of his wicked Walker Colts. 3 Sleep's gun misfired. One of the ambushers grabbed the opportunity to charge him. Preacher wheeled around in the saddle.
Obliged, Preacher!
My pleasure!
By then, they had ridden in amongst those who had laid the ambush. Preacher struck one down with the barrel of his Colt, then shot another who sprang upward to fire wildly. Preacher quickly exchanged Colts. Stunned by the incredible firepower of the mountain men, Border Trash fell back as their intended victims kept on coming. In rapid order, their number had diminished to a mere 7. Yet they still outnumbered the men they had come to kill by 2-1. Preacher and Antoine quickly reduced that advantage.
Sacre bleu! I've shot myself dry, my friend!
You got a warhawk, ain't you?
Antoine brightened and brought forth a wicked-looking iron-bladed tomahawk. Thug in front of him paled and threw a wild shot. The ball made a red line along Antoine's rib. Preacher heel thundered to one side. A fear-stamped face popped out of the underbrush. Preacher was not surprised to recognize the straw-haired rascal who'd been dogging their trail since Cottonwood Crossing.
Don't shoot! I give up, I'm hurt bad!
Another disreputable creature crawled into the open. His usually coppery complexion had turned a sickly gray-green. Thin wisps of mustache were matted around his face by sweat. He dragged a bloody leg with a bullet-shattered thigh bone.
Oh, don't kill us!
Preacher and his friend surrounded the defeated pair.
Now ain't this something? Haven't we met someplace before?
You know damn well we have. You gonna stop this bleeding?
Preacher examined the wound in the side of the ruffian without moving from his horse.
We might if we get some straight answers. Like to start, do you have a name?
Of course. Everyone has a name. Mine's Amos Scraggs. This is my pard, Miguel Lopez. But we don't know nothing about nothing.
Bullshit.
What if we don't tell you?
We leave you here to bleed to death.
You'd never do a thing like that. What you want to know?
It's just another fling for you, like that freighter train?
Well, no. We were sent to see that you never reached Missouri.
Who's we? That include the scruffy lot you rode with?
No. We weren't no part of them. I asked Miguel. That bunch was pure trash. Miguel and me joined up for that raid on the freight wagons just to make more money.
Miguel, who believed incorrectly that he was about to die, sought to absolve himself before he met his maker. He motioned to Preacher. The mountain man squatted down beside the Mexican bandit.
What is it?
Don't tell him nothing!
I will tell you the truth, Senor Preacher. The whole gang have been paid well to kill you.
Who paid you?
Three men. They are called Gross, Prager, and Riker.
You done good, Miguel. I'm sure the Almighty will take that into account.
Por favor, please, I want a priest. I want to make my confession.
We'll see if we can find you one. But first off, we gotta bind up that wound.
Takes, Rain, and Gray Eagle looked downslope at the laboring of the draft animals. A mixed train of mules and oxen trudged through the roiling red-brown dust of a sage-choked basin near the banks of the Yellowstone River. Takes Rain knew that soon they would stop to take food, and a cold smile lifted the corners of his mouth. Before long, his Bison Eater Society would test the power of the medicine given by Iron Shirt. The rolling lodges began to slow and swing into a half circle. Women dismounted. Takes Rain cut his eyes to Gray Eagle and nodded. Both men came to their moccasins. Swiftly, they mounted. 30 other warriors did the same. Takes Rain raised the new rifle he had been given by the followers of Iron Shirt and waved it over his head. Startled white faces looked up at him. Then the warriors hidden around the wagons in the thick covering of sagebrush opened fire. Thirty Blackfoot warriors thundered down the slope to flow through their comrades and bring more death and destruction. The immigrants finally began to react. Several men grabbed up rifles and returned fire. The bullets seemed to avoid all the mounted engines. Another volley had as little effect. Five men died before they could reload. Children ran in panic. Warriors rode in amongst them, oblivious to the white men's bullets. Blackfoot bent low and scooped small boys and girls off their feet, then whirled away from the scene of battle. Seizing a flaming brand from a cook fire, Gray Eagle hurled it into the rear of a wagon. Flames quickly licked up. A woman with graying hair and two barely nubile girls tumbled out. The woman died from a lance thrust. The girls were dragged aside to provide later amusement for the aroused warriors. Unable to reload in the swirl of battle, Takes Rain slung his fine new rifle over one shoulder by a rawhide thong and drew his tomahawk. Horror filled the face of the white man who watched the grinning warrior with the war axe descend on him. Then a man with a shotgun found one savage within range and gave out a load of double-aught buckshot. Dismayed, the warriors nearest him looked on in disbelief when he slumped dead over the neck of his horse. Takes Rain's head rolled in confusion.
confusion. Maybe the medicine was not good against the many bald guns. Sensing the loss of faith among its companions, though, Take Rain signaled for the Braves to follow him as he streaked away. They took the young women and small children with them. Only two adults had survived the attack. They stood in numb despair as flames licked at four wagons. Slowly, they looked around at the scene of slaughter. At an isolated trading post on the North Platte River, Prager and his partners received a message from Washington City. Instructions written on the outside had told the proprietor to hold it until called for. Prager, whose aggressive qualities and dominance had propelled him without dissent into leadership, split the wax seal and opened the thick threefold paper. He read it quickly, then raised his mottled blue eyes. The slight cast in the right one disconcerting as always. He smiled.
It is short and sweet, gentlemen. We are informed that arrangements have been completed for stage two. Those involved will be on their way within a week.
Morton Gross rubbed pudgy hands together.
Wonderful. How long will it take them to get out here?
I would imagine 6 weeks to 2 months. Unless they take the mail packet or some other steam-powered riverboat.
And our little impediment?
You mean Preacher? By now, I assume he has been taken care of. Come, this calls for a celebration. Barman, do you have any champagne?
Any what? I ain't seen no champagne since I moved out here. Shit, never saw none before that, neither.
Do you have a good rye?
Oh, I got a small barrel from the Cumberland Gap country.
That will do quite well.
Prager turned to the others.
Now, we have to get Iron Shirt to move faster on enlisting the Cheyenne. They are the key to the whole thing.
Across the Missouri now and drawing nearer to Jefferson Barracks each hour, Preacher felt downright uneasy.
It's too crowded around here. Well, there's actually more than one house per mile these days. Not fitting nor healthy for folks to live all shoved up against one another like that.
What do you consider comfortable living space, Preacher?
Well, I reckon one per 10 or 20 miles. That'd be the absolute limit I could tolerate.
Uh-oh. Trouble ahead.
Three sleeps indicated a group of armed men who sat astride the high road. The bulk of their horses blocked the advance of the mountain men. A big, ugly brute with orange-red hair and matching beard, who was in the middle of the ragged formation, raised a hand and pointed one thick finger imperiously at Preacher.
What you fellas' business? Well, friend, we're on our way to, Independence.
Well, it be back the way you came, so you'd best turn around and light a shuck out of here. There ain't no room for frontier riffraff the likes of you three among civilized folk here in Missouri.
Well then, we'll just have to make some room.
Preacher leaped like a panther from the back of thunder. His powerful arms looped around the leader of the welcoming party and dragged the bigger man from the saddle. With a lithe twist, Preacher turned him in midair so that the carrot-topped brute landed on his back with Preacher atop him. Preacher saw the lapels of the big man's hairy cowhide vest across his throat.
You're joking me!
Yeah, that was the idea. Now, we might not be the most splendid fellas you ever seen, that I'll allow. But you and your friends ain't no prize winners yourself. Now, I'd appreciate it if you could find it in your heart to be more cordial than you greet.
Well, it worked for them like it did for the Spanish on the Llano Estacado. Eve Billings thrilled at the sight of the 15-foot shafts, the colorful cloth pennants fluttering in the hot breeze that blew across the sandy soil of the Great Basin. From the ridge where her wagon rested, she could see a line of them leading back to their starting place and on into the distance beyond. Progress had been slow at first. They'd barely made 7 miles a day the first 3 days because the neophyte scouts frequently dashed back with alarms that proved unfounded. Now, Davy Honeycutt galloped a lathered horseback, his eyes as enlarged as his mount.
Engines! Engines not 5 miles ahead!
From the color of his face, one would suspect they were the ghosts of Injuns. A party of armed men rode forward to investigate. After a while, Eve could see him returning, small black specks against the blasted earth. Beside her, Charlie stirred on the seat and shifted his rifle.
Well, they're not waving a red flag, Mom. We can thank the Lord for that.
Aw, Mom, I want to shoot an Injun.
No, you don't, Charles Ryan Billings. You don't want to shoot any human. Hunting for food is a necessity. Killing someone is a horrid crime.
Even if they're trying to kill you?
You're just a boy, Charlie. Leave those sorts of things to grown men.
Some of the less alarmist among the travelers started their wagons out toward the approaching men. There would have been shots, after all, had there been Injuns. Overall, Eve remained highly pleased at their progress. Even better, the game, which had been absent on their first attempt, now seemed to have come back in abundance. Anna was growing stronger every hour, and Charlie had become quite an expert shot, adding to his credit deer and antelope as well as rabbits. She put the Bridesburg Arsenal rifle aside and turned to Charlie.
Put your rifle up, Charlie. We're heading out.
Can I take Star out and hunt a little?
No need today, son. Remember those plump rabbits Damien Brewster brought us?
Oh, yeah, those.
Charlie replaced his rifle in the wagon bed and scampered out to his usual place astride Jake. His bare heels bounced with the churning rhythm of the stolid animal. Once again, Eve surveyed her world and found herself entirely at peace. Then she looked up from the rumps of her team to see a solitary Injun sitting on top of a close-by mound. Sudden cold clutched at her heart. She tensed and reached for the rifle at her feet when the Injun slowly began to raise his lance. Extending to full arm's length, the Injun moved his lance from side to side. Appearing that to be the signal for an attack, he filled her lungs for a cry of alarm, only to realize that it was just a friendly wave, backed up by a broad smile. At Jefferson Barracks at last, Preacher found the situation and the troops even sorrier than he expected. The Dragoons turned out to be raw and green, barely aware of what was expected of them.
No, damn it, Mallory! For the love of Jesus, how many times do I have to tell you? Your mounts or your face in the same direction, the horses, you fool!
I don't know why I get so mixed up, Sergeant Muldoon. Honest, I don't. Maybe I ain't a horse person.
Battalion Sergeant Major Terrence Muldoon threw down the riding crop he carried and strode to Mallory's side. He shoved his face to within an inch of Mallory's.
It's Sergeant Major, you dimwit. Now you go get your knapsack, you fill it with some rocks, and you report back here to me on the double!
Sergeant Major, are you gonna make me run around this big old field here?
Field? Parade ground, damn it! Parade ground!
Ain't seen no parades go by since we've been here.
Oh, you sorry son of a haggis! Oh, what the hell? It's no use. You're no use! Sure, and sometimes I think I'm no use. I do. Oh, get the knapsack!
Yeah, sure, Sergeant Major.
Excuse me, Sergeant Major. Could you tell me where I can find Colonel Danvers?
BSM Terrence Muldoon turned to Preacher.
In St. Louis.
May I ask what he's doing there?
Who are you?
Well, they call me Preacher. This is Three Sleeps Norse and Antoine Revier. We're reporting in as guides for this battalion through the Injun country.
Muldoon put his fists on his hips, feet wide apart in a belligerent stance.
Three Sleeps, not Antoine Revier. Those are puff's names. I'm Battalion Sergeant Major Muldoon. That's a real fucking name. And for your information, the good colonel and those young gentlemen officers of his wanted a last fling among the ladies and the sparkling wine before making their great sacrifice for God and their country.
They left you in charge?
No, Mr. Preacher. We got us one officer with his brains in his head, not in his pants. Captain Edward Drayling is commanding at present. Aye. You can find him at Battalion Headquarters, across the parade ground there.
Thank you, Sergeant Major.
Preacher turned to leave as Mallory returned. The knapsack bounced viciously against his shoulders and back as he began to run. The black visor of his flat-topped bill cap slid slowly down his forehead until it obscured his eyes. Preacher stared at him as though seeing a creature from another planet.
Lord God.
Does that do any good, Sergeant Major?
Not with that one, it doesn't. There's some fine lads here. Aye, smart and quick to learn. But that one has to take off a boot to count to 11. Silly whore. I fear what'll become of him out there.
Preacher and the other mountain men walked their horses to the headquarters building, where an orderly told them Captain Draylen could be found on the firing range on the far side of the cantonment. Seated on a canvas-backed camp stool, an officer observed while sweating sergeants conducted firing exercises. The captain wore the split-tail regulation blue uniform coat with thick, shaggy brass epaulets at the shoulder points, matching insignia of rank, three horizontal strips on the high, tight collar. His trousers, with the gold stripe down the seams, covered the high tops of his black boots. His shako-style hat, black patent leather, complete with horsehair plume that drooped over the front, sat squarely on a round, blonde head. Somehow, he managed to seem cool and comfortable, while the NCOs and enlisted men showed wide rings at their armpits and long, wet smears down their backs. Their appearances made even Preacher feel uncomfortable. Captain Draylen had no difficulty in recognizing the newcomer. He rose and extended a hand.
You must be our guides.
That we are. You be Captain Draylen?
At 6 foot even, the broad shoulders, full chest, and narrow hips gave Draylen a handsome cut by anyone's standards.
Yes. However, on informal occasions, you may call me Edward.
And you can call me Preacher. I don't mean to pry into Army business, Captain, but may I ask why you didn't join your associates in the pleasures of St. Louis?
Bloody damn children, you ask me. Most of these rabble cannot yet tell right from left foot, let alone conduct themselves as soldiers. And the ones with the responsibility to hammer them into shape go off skirt chasing.
Shit!
You goddamn idiot! You get the fucking lash for that! I said clear all weapons before leaving the line!
A fist lashed out and knocked the offender sprawling. The sergeant kicked him in the ribs twice.
Excuse me.
Draylen turned to the enraged NCO.
Enough of that, Sergeant Peters. Extra duty for Emmons, and 4 punishment tours should suffice. No one was injured.
Yes, sir. Very good, sir. It will be done as ordered. Now, you worthless reprobate, keep that muzzle downrange at all times, you hear?
The rest of the day's tour of the battalion established some strong opinions in Preacher. At the stable area, soldiers tried rear vault and running side mounts, mostly falling in the dirt over and over. Sergeants screamed and cursed. Those who could ride, Preacher soon learned, couldn't hit a bull in the ass with a bass fiddle, let alone score on a target from a prone position with their weapons. Which left him with a rather dim view of Colonel Arlington Danvers, the battalion commander. If the other officers, save Captain Draylen, were as ill-concerned about the readiness of their men, they could all be in for one hell of a time out in the high lonesome. Instinct told them to seek out the battalion staff in St. Louis at once. Logic told them to wait here, lend a hand where he could, and hope for the best when the errant officers returned. Whatever came of this, Preacher promised himself, he would sure as hell never take a job with the Army again. Lieutenant Colonel Arlington Danvers and his officers returned to Jefferson Barracks 5 days later. To the expert eyes of Preachers and his mountain man friends, they all looked powerfully hungover and sadly dissipated. I mean an all-around surly lot. Based on the harshness of the non-coms and the appearance and deportment of Lieutenant Colonel Danvers, Preacher figured the colonel was a martinet and thorough popinjay. This opinion was reinforced when they reported to Danvers in a barred office intended for some of the permanent staff. The colonel looked up and his lip curled with contempt and disgust.
You're a scruffy-looking lot, I must say. Do you ever take baths? You'll have to in this army.
Pardon me, Colonel, but we ain't in this army. We're just hired to guide you to where you want to go in the big empty.
Yes. Well, from now on, until the completion of your employment, you will all refrain from spirits, liquor of any sort, and you will clean up your clothing and present a well-washed appearance at all times. Your hair is to be cut to regulation length, and all facial hair is forbidden. You are to ride out before dawn each morning, scout the territory ahead, and send back reports. You will not fraternize with the officers, non-commissioned officers, or the enlisted men of my command. You will negotiate safe passage for us with any savages you encounter. You are to make certain that the path we take is wide enough to accommodate mounted troops, four abreast with our field piece at the center of the column, and wagons too wide to the rear.
Preacher bristled. He'd heard just about all of you will and you are that he could swallow without getting a sick stomach.
Now, whoa up there, Second Colonel. Exactly who are to be the guides for this expedition?
Why, you three, of course.
Well, then, don't the Colonel think that the men in charge should have some say in how the soldier boys will march?
Regulations cover that quite nicely, I believe.
Ain't no regulation out there in the high lonesome. And as for the trail, depending on which way you intend to go, there ain't no real trail at all. We just have to find the best way through, over or around the rocks, rivers, gorges, hills, and so on. And do it without breaking every wheel or upsetting any loads. Now, marching four abreast might be well and good on a wide street or a grassy meadow, but not out here. There's cactus with thorns long and sharp enough to pierce a horse's hoof to the cannon bone. There's prairie dog holes just waiting to bust a leg. Then you have bison who'll stampede at any loud sound, and rattlesnakes that could fell a horse as easy as a man. Not to mention Injuns by the thousands. Nope. Two men to a file, and they alternately walk and ride their mounts. Oh, and another thing. No horn tooting or drum banging. That's the surest goddamn way to attract some unpleasant Injuns. Those fancy sabers y'all are so fond of has got to be padded and tied down, too, so they don't rattle, and all tack and loose gear. An Injun can hear the noise they make a mile away.
We absolutely must have trumpet calls and drums to convey orders. Typical civilian ignorance.
Ain't you ever heard of arm signals? You know the Injuns have used them for ages. They get along just dandy.
And field music is essential for morale.
Well, I wonder how serious you are about getting there and getting your fort built before you take on the hostiles. If you have your soldier boys practice arm signals while we're still in friendly country, they'll know them when they need them. Me, I say it's a smart thing to do.
They are dragoons, Mr. Preacher. Dragoons.
No matter what Preacher proposed, Lieutenant Colonel Danvers balked at adopting. At last, Preacher just about reached his limit.
Here's my final word on this, Colonel. We're going to do it my way, or I quit the job and hand the money back to the government.
Very well. It will be as you say.
The column moved out early the next morning. To Preacher's surprise, the troops had improved greatly. They sat their horses straight and tall, all of them required to be no less than 5'10" to 6'2" in height. Not a one fell off his horse. On the high road outside the barracks ground, they rode four abreast. For all their smart appearance, Preacher sensed something odd. He rode in a relaxed slouch with Three Sleeps and Antoine some 200 yards ahead of the battalion commander and his staff and flag bearers. Preacher glanced constantly behind him, his gaze resting long on the files of men and horses.
You feel the two, Three Sleeps? It got me a strong sensation that something's mighty wrong.
I don't follow you.
I don't know exactly how, but these greenhorn soldier boys have done messed up the work something powerful.
And we'll find out eventual.
I certain sure hope it's soon enough.
They found out the first time they stopped.
What do you mean they were left behind, Hadley?
Slanted backward from the glowering red face of the battalion sergeant major, who leaned over him, the quartermaster sergeant, Hadley, gulped hard before answering.
Sergeant Major, four of my teamsters reported to sick call this morning, and there was no one to drive the wagons.
And why wasn't I told any of this, huh?
You were, sir. I reported four men confined in the infirmary.
BSM Muldoon poked a thick finger into Hadley's chest and kept poking.
But you didn't tell me four wagons didn't have drivers!
Sergeant Hadley looked like he was about to be sick all over his shiny boots.
I thought you'd figure that out for yourself, Sergeant Major.
You're flirting with insubordination, Hadley. Lord love us! We'll have to send men back to recover them now, eh?
Muldoon spun on one heel.
Right, you four. Collins, Masters, Pickerel, and Sawyer. Mount up and ride like hell back to the barracks. You'll find four supply wagons there, which some puffs forgot to drive. Bring him up with the column right quickly, lads. All right?
What about evening chow, Sergeant Major?
You have to think of everything! Take food enough with you for two or three meals, Corporal Collins!
But, sir, they're not Teamsters.
And I'm not your mother! Sure, and I don't give a damn if they're all made school teachers. We need those supplies. Now go along and get the wagons, Dorothy!
Preacher watched the whole scene in disgust. Good God! Here we are having made 15 miles the first day and we've lost half the supplies. At this rate, we won't make the North Platte till December.
Far from the foothills of the Ozark Mountains in Missouri, at a large, well-tended trading post on the North Platte River, Quentin Prager sat at a table with his co-conspirators and their chief henchman, Blake Sowers. All four men lapsed into silence when a large platter of roast bison hump arrived at their table. They ate heartily, pleasurably chewing slabs of the layered meat and fat, along with boiled turnips and onions, squash and chili peppers, all washed down with tankards of beer. Not until the last morsel disappeared did Prager bring up business.
Everything is going according to schedule. The money is starting to roll in from back east. The Dragoons are to have left Jefferson Barracks yesterday. We should have us a tidy little Indian war before too long.
Exactly what is behind this plan to stir up the Indians? That is, after all, a dangerous thing to do.
Morton Gross looked amused.
How is that, Mr. Sowers?
A fella can be their friend and ally one day, and the next they'll lift his hair. They're changeable, moody.
The idea is to get rid of them once and for all. And the best way to do that is to get an Indian war started. We can count on the Indians doing their part through Iron Shirt. He has tremendous influence among the Blackfoot, and now with the Cheyenne. His power grows daily.
That's the part I don't like, what I'm trying to warn you about. I got 17 good men riding with me. Then there's you three. 22 guns don't amount to a fart in a windstorm if Iron Shirt decides he don't need us anymore.
Aaron Riker gave Blake Sowers a condescending smirk.
I think you are overestimating his capacity for duplicity. We provide him with rifles and ammunition, and we brought him out of obscurity and made him famous. No, friend Sowers, we can trust Iron Shirt.
But why get rid of the Indians at all? That's what I want to know.
Well, the East is getting crowded. The land these Indians occupy will be valuable in any westward expansion. Certain high-placed interests in Washington City have a desire to lay claim to that ground, at least once the savages have been eliminated.
But ain't it Injun's land?
Our friends in Washington City are paying exceedingly well to see that it no longer is. Well enough to assuage any conscience.
What's that mean, assuage?
To pacify, Mr. Sowers, to calm.
None of the conspirators mentioned the presence of gold in the mountains of Montana. Instead, they directed him to an assignment as backup to the men sent to stop Preacher.
There is only one impediment, one man who might be able to prevent an all-out war of extermination. His name is Preacher, and he is known and respected by both sides. Only, if all went well, he should be out of the picture by now. If he is not, it will be your job to remove him.
True to Preacher's prediction, a whole hell of a lot was wrong with the expedition. Trouble began before the troops got out of Missouri. After the four supply wagons joined the column, finally, they made better time. But a lot of good that did them. A harried-looking dragoon had ridden in on a lathered horse. What he revealed sent Muldoon to seek help from the mountain men.
Gentlemen, I come to you with a wee problem. Now, mind, I could send some of my sergeants to deal with this, but then it would become an official matter, right?
Well, come on, spit it out, man.
The thing is, some of the lads have taken it to mind to slip off from our encampment and indulge themselves in some spirituous waters. In the process, they've got themselves afoul of some of the local citizens. The fact of the matter is, there's apparently one hell of a fine brawl going on between some 8 dragoons who should be fighting a fucking war and some sawyers from a nearby mill.
And you would appreciate some small gesture of aid from the three of us?
Aye, well, it would avoid the messiness of a court-martial and the need for punishment.
We'd not be taking sides. We'll bust anyone who gets in our way.
The skin in your knuckles on all comers, eh? Well, so be it. I'll be accompanying you, Buckles, though not in an official capacity.
All right, Muldoon. We'll head out now.
They trotted up to the tie rail outside and looped reins over the crossbar. The preacher looked up as a man flew bodily out through a window.
Holy shit, looks like we got us a job on our hands.
You're not lying there, preacher.
With determination, the four men stalked to the door. It flew open in their faces and two men wrapped in a mutual bear hug stumbled out. Being nearest, the preacher reached out and grabbed both miscreants by the hair and slammed their heads together. BSM Muldoon bent and separated the dragoon from the lumberman and dragged him to the hitch rack. The three mountain men entered the establishment. It had been a nicely appointed place before the fight began. Now, splintered tables and chairs floated like driftwood in a tidal pool of beer, which had come from a ruptured hog's head. There had once been a mirror behind the bar. It lay in diamond spears of brightness amid overturned bottles and small casks. One of the ceiling supports had been snapped in two. The roof sagged dangerously above it. Showing even worse signs of wear, eight men remained on their feet, flinging fists with wild abandon. Preacher stepped through and took the knuckles of a huge sawyer at the under edge of his right eye.
God damn it, that's plumb uncalled for!
Preacher set his feet and pile-drivered a steady rain of punches to the sturdy frame of the sandy-haired man who had hit him. Three Sleeps and Antoine waded in behind Preacher, and the three started picking dragoons off their opponents and hauling them toward the door.
Take your damn hands off me!
Three Sleeps swiftly closed his right hand into a fist and popped the dragoon flush in the mouth. Three Sleeps grabbed the downed soldier by the collar and dragged him out into the dooryard. Then, with a grin, he turned about and went back for more.
Those mountain fellas sure love a fight. Hey, there must be a bunch of mix.
Muldoon added another young soldier to the stack, thrown by the tie rail. Preacher hurled another protesting dragoon out the door.
I'll kick your ass, you backstabbing mountain.
Take that, Barbara!
Muldoon silenced the boy the best way he knew how.
You let us at those soldier boys. We'll tear them limb from limb.
Oh, calm down. We're taking them back where they belong.
Not again.
Following instinct and training, the remaining dragoons dropped to the floor the instant the shot went off. Preacher and his companions didn't. Antoine reached down and felt a hot, burning gouge along his ribs that oozed blood. That made both sides. He'd be sore than a fresh gilded hound dog for more than a month. Antoine reached for one of his double-barreled pistols, but Preacher beat him to the draw. None of the Missouri lumbermen had ever seen a revolving pistol before. From the floor, they stared at it in dumb silence.
Unless any of you is eager to argue with my friend, Mr. Walker here, I'd advise you to forget all about tearing anyone else limb from limb.
You just killed Tucker Blake!
Did I? Hell, I didn't know his name. But it don't matter anyways. What matters is, your Mr. Blake drew first. What's more, he shot a friend of mine. I don't take kindly to that. Though I will say I'm sorry your friend is dead.
You won't get away with this. We'll get the sheriff on you.
It was self-defense. Any fool can see that.
Not any Missouri fool, preacher. I suggest we send for the sheriff ourselves and let him hear both sides of the story.
How far off is your sheriff?
He's right here. I'd put that smoke pole up if I was you.
The man who entered the tavern was of a size with Preacher, though he carried authority and power with him enough to make him 10 feet tall.
Sheriff Bill Parker, what happened here?
This stranger come through the door, bold as brass, and shot down Tucker Blake in cold blood.
If that's the case, George, what accounts for the pistol in Tucker's hand?
One of his friends put it there.
Sheriff Parker turned and eyed Antoine.
Was that before or after this fella got his ribs skinned?
He whirled back to face the sawmill men.
Now, boys, my mama didn't raise any stupid sons. What do you take me for? That's Tucker's pistol. I've had to take it off him enough times when he got drunked up. I was on my way here when I heard the shots. Collie Burks came by to tell me there was a big fight going betwixt you boys and some soldiers. I'd have been in here sooner if I hadn't stopped to have a word with the sergeant out there.
That's Sergeant Major, if you please, Sheriff. Battalion Sergeant Major Muldoon. Now, if you don't mind, I'll be taking my lads and our brave frontier guides back to our camp.
Go right ahead, Sergeant Major Muldoon.
The sheriff turned to Antoine.
I'd get that patched up right quick. Might fester.
Thank you for the good advice, Sheriff.
Outside, Muldoon surveyed the heavily subdued or flat-out unconscious dragoons.
Oh, thank my Auntie Mabel their horses are right at hand. Be a thankless task rousing them all to walk that far.
We'll lend a hand getting them across their mounts.
That won't be necessary. There's enough of them with their wits about them to do that.
If I was any of you, I'd get me as far and as fast out of Missouri as I could. We got friends.
No sooner had the errant dragoons been returned to the camp near Sedalia than Lieutenant Colonel Danvers summoned the necessary members for a drumhead court-martial. Now, having been assured that he had acquired a shiner and more sore ribs for the purpose of avoiding this very event, Preacher had his curiosity aroused. He went along to witness. Naturally, his companions accompanied him. Preacher couldn't believe the abrupt nature of the proceeding. All eight of the disobedient dragoons were hauled before a lantern-lighted barrelhead over which Danvers presided. He read off a list of charges, including desertion, absent without leave, public drunkenness, and inciting to riot. He didn't ask how the accused pleaded.
Now, as regards Corporal Evers and Privates Fields, Smith, and O'Banion, the charges of desertion and absent without leave are dismissed. On the counts of public drunkenness and inciting to riot, the above-named soldiers are fined 2/3 of a month's pay for 3 months. Now, Privates Babcock, Upton, Venner, and Colleen, you are sentenced to be stretched upon a wagon wheel and given 6 strokes of the lash.
Are you not giving them a chance to plead their case, Colonel, sir?
Contain yourself, Sergeant Major.
But, Colonel, sir...
Would you like to join them at the grate?
Captain Drelling leaned close to Lieutenant Colonel Danvers.
Regulations, Colonel. You are always saying that. And in this case, regulations will not allow you to flog the battalion sergeant major without a full general court-martial.
Yes. Yes, you are right, as usual, Captain. Much to my regret, I might add. He should never have gone after these fools. Sentence to be carried out at once.
Although outraged by the punishment, Preacher remained to watch it carried out. Afterward, he fetched a jug from a parflesh on his pack horse, and regulations be damned, he got rip-roaring drunk along with his friends and BSM Muldoon. Two wagons had broken down that day. Eve Billings was beginning to have second thoughts. After the past 3 days of soul-searching, she had made up her mind to go to Isaac Warner, who had been elected captain for their attempt at crossing the basin. She put aside the last of the dishes from supper and walked reluctantly to his wagon.
I have an idea what it is you want to say, and I want some of the other men to be here to hear it.
Warner gave a wave of one arm to Damian Brewster to summon him from his family cook fire a third of the way around the circle of wagons. When the youth arrived, Warner gave him curt orders. In short time, Renard Labette and Hiram Tate ambled up. They were immediately joined by Gus Beecher and Cecil Brewster. Beecher gave a less than polite nod to Eve.
What's up, Isaac?
The Widow Billings here has something she wants to tell us. Now go ahead, don't be shy.
You know about the breakdowns. Not only those today, the others. They're taking a heavy toll.
Yep. Said that was what would happen. Go on.
Also, game of water are growing scarce again. I feel... It seems to me the time has come to examine our decision to try making a crossing.
What you're getting at is...
Those of us who favored the attempt had no idea how strenuous it would be. It is perhaps time to consider the possibility of turning around and following the stakes to the edge of the basin and then going beyond to fresh water and plentiful game.
I say it's the wrong thing to do.
Yes. We've come this far. There can't be much more like this.
Eve's torment and humiliation lasted a long time while the men wrangled over what should be done. Her patience at last exhausted by their circular reasoning, Eve slipped away. Dredging up new hope, she went out to seek the wives. The first was Hattie Honeycutt, to whom Eve recited what she had pointed out to the men.
We have to make them see reason. There has to be a way.
But we're mere women. Our menfolk have total sway over us.
Not in all things.
Name me one.
Eve leaned forward and whispered in Hattie Honeycutt's ear.
That would never work. Why, they would just...
No, they wouldn't. Not if we all stuck to it. And not if we slept with a loaded gun at hand.
My word, it's such a strange idea.
Eve went from wife to wife, explaining their womanly rebellion. Whenever she was told it could not possibly work, she smiled enigmatically and dropped the final gem of her argument.
Well, it's worked before. It happened back in ancient times. There was this woman named Lysistrata.
After that, it became easy. One by one, the women approached their husbands and whispered in their ears.
You what?
Isaac Warner's wife told them a second time. Several other men repeated Isaac's shocked response on being informed, only to be assured that their wives meant exactly what they said. Visibly shaken, by noon of the next day, they began to admit that maybe that pushy woman, the widow Billings, might be right for once. If they did return to the foothills, they would have graze for livestock, fresh water, and a chance to hunt for their food. Lieutenant Colonel Danvers summoned Preacher to his tent, yet he would not directly meet the eyes of the mountain man.
Preacher, due to the delays, I have decided that we shall negotiate this portion of our journey by riverboat. It will cut a month off our travel time.
That's mighty smart thinking, Colonel. I'd never come up with it myself, what with being used to crossing the mountains by horse or shanks mare.
No, I suppose not. Advise your assistance and be prepared to board tomorrow when we reach Independence.
The next day, they did just that. Two by two, the dragoon horses went aboard a livestock barge to be towed by the rearmost of 16 packets requisitioned by Lieutenant Colonel Danvers. They had been paid for by a voucher drawn on the Department of the Army. Danvers, who oversaw the operation from beside Preacher, turned to the mountain man.
Due to your positions as scouts, you hold ranks equivalent to a captain's and to lieutenant's. Therefore, you will be billeted aboard the lead vessel with myself and the other officers.
That's plump considerate of you, Colonel.
It is not out of consideration, believe me.
Yeah, I know. It's regulations.
Well put.
It'll be a pleasure for all, I'm sure.
Dean Packet Prairie Spirit pulled away from the dock in Independence at 3:30 that afternoon. On board were the battalion commander, his staff, the captains commanding the four squadrons, and the three scouts. Also one company of dragoons. The blunt prow nudged into the Missouri River's brown water and began to struggle to overcome the current to make way upstream. The huge side-mounted paddle wheels thrashed the water and sent off a fine spray of mist. Rainbows formed in a nimbus around each churning wheel. The 15 civilian passengers left the rail and went to their staterooms to open trunks and prepare clothing for dinner. Several of the men made their way to the gentleman's salon. Preacher and his companions located their accommodations and dumped their belongings in the corners.
I don't know if I'm going to like this, outside all the time it'll save, of course.
Why is that, Preacher?
Well, I never felt entirely comfortable on the water, Antoine. Nothing I can put a finger on, but it just don't seem natural. I mean, water's for fishes and beaver.
Didn't you like to swim when you were young?
Now, tell you the truth, Three Sleeps, I was over 12 and living with the Cheyenne before I learned how to swim right proper-like. Up till then, I just paddled around like a spaniel after ducks, not liking it much neither. You know what's funny? I put money in Mr. Fulton's steamboat works, and this is only the third time I ever rid one of the contraptions.
I have heard that the boilers blow up sometimes.
Yeah, that they do. Usually it's because the stokers overfill the fireboxes or the metal is old.
How does one tell if the metal is old?
I don't know. I sure hope to hell the captain and the engineer have some idea.
The mountain men changed into cloth suits and boots and took dinner at 7 o'clock, an hour before the sun went down. That only served to amplify Preacher's uneasiness. The truth the Preacher would not admit to was that prolonged travel over water made his stomach queasy. Although he didn't suffer dizziness and nausea, it did make him develop gas. Preacher soon found himself out on the foredeck, a hand gently pressing his belly. Preacher was still there, the rumble somewhat subsided, when a conversation among three fellow travelers advised him there were card games in the gentleman's salon. Despite his precarious internal state, the lure of the pasteboards drew him like a dead critter attracted flies. After sitting in for an hour, Preacher grew increasingly edgy as an oily fellow with a remarkable deck of cards made deep dents in his government money, paid in advance for services rendered. Beauregard Calhoun, slim and dapper, with a thin pencil line of a mustache and manicured fingernails, gave a shark's grin as he raked in yet another pot. Preacher allowed us how he should keep an eye on Calhoun and discover the source of his unusual luck.
You all seem to be having a terrible run of luck. I learned to court the lady at a tender age, and I never failed to pay her homage.
It appears to me that her favors have been sort of phenomenal.
Calhoun gave Preacher a fishy eye. After three more hands, two of which were won by Calhoun, Preacher deliberately discarded an ace of clubs during the next, which he discreetly creased with a thumbnail. Sure enough, Calhoun won again. His full house of aces and tens contained the ace of clubs. Before Calhoun could pick up the hand which he had won, Preacher came to his boots, leaned across the table, and clamped a hard hand over Calhoun's wrist.
See here! There's nothing to be gained by this sort of conduct. Release me, my man!
I ain't your man nor any others. I find it right interesting you won that hand with the ace of clubs, especially since I discarded that same card in the draw.
You can't prove that.
Preacher looked at the men at the table.
Oh, yes, I can. You see, gents, I took the trouble to crease that card with a thumbnail before I dropped it on the table. By that time, I'd got myself the idea that this particular deck had a special set of marks Calhoun here can read.
Preacher squeezed tighter as Calhoun began to squirm.
I must protest! You'll not find a crease on that card, sir!
No, I don't reckon I will. But I am willing to bet I'll find the crimped one up your sleeve or in your vest pocket. Somewhere, anyway. You saw what I was getting rid of and couldn't resist the urge to put another one into your hand to improve it.
Are you calling me a cheat, sir?
Preacher's eyes bored deeply into those of Calhoun, while his free hand delved into the sleeve of the fancy suit Calhoun wore. Deftly, Preacher produced the card in question.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Then I demand immediate satisfaction.
With these words, Beauregard Calhoun thrust his left hand under the wing of his coat and came out with a small 36 caliber double-barreled pocket pistol. Preacher responded with the speed of a puma, backhanded Calhoun. Beauregard Calhoun shot back from the table, spun slightly, and reeled drunkenly toward the bar. At the last moment, before he made violent impact, he remembered the pistol in his hand. The bullet hit the bull bison hide belt Preacher wore around his middle. Immediately, Beauregard rotated the barrel, but he was too late.
You done played your last hand.
Thick layer of powder smoke undulated in the space between Preacher and the dead cheat. Slowly, Preacher reached down and plucked the little ball from the thick leather of his belt. A worried player hurried up to him.
Didn't get all the way through, but I'm going to be sore as hell for a week. Awful bruise, you can bet.
You've been saved by a miracle.
Nope. Buffalo hide belt. Little pop gun didn't have a chance.
The well-dressed man went over and crouched beside Beauregard.
He's dead.
Yeah, well, I wasn't aiming to tickle him.
A cluster of onlookers at the doorway gave room for the first officer to enter, who was buttoning his jacket as he crossed the room.
Someone tell me what happened, and sir, I advise you to put away that revolver.
Preacher complied while the well-dressed man at his side made explanation.
I'm Norton Babbitt, of Babbitt Bobbin Company. This gentleman caught a cheat in our game. The scoundrel pulled a gun on him and shot him. The rest you can see for yourself.
I know this man. It's Beauregard Calhoun. We've had complaints about him before.
The officer cut his eyes to Preacher.
You're a brave man to have faced him down. Or a fool.
Yeah, right now I feel more like a fool.
It happened, as Mr. Babbitt said?
Yeah, more or less.
How did you manage to detect him cheating?
I spend as much time watching the players as I do the cards in a game. Calhoun had a marked deck and he used holdout cards, too.
I'll explain to the captain. He may want to speak with you. You're not planning to disembark soon, are you?
Nope. Not until I get these baby soldiers to the Upper North Platte.
And your name, sir?
I'm called Preacher.
Preacher? So that's why you're standing and he's not. Yes, I see now. Very well, Preacher. From here on, it's merely a formality.
Time to reload. The First Mountain Man has continued on the next CD.